Chapter 8. Dearest David, astounding news. Mrs. Pusey, that pinnacle of feminine chic, that arbiter of taste, that relentless seeker of luxury goods, that charmer of multitudes, is 79. I know this because she had a birthday 2 days ago and we were all invited to celebrate. Preliminary rumours that something was afoot had reached me earlier in the day, and I was going out along the corridor. I heard cries of delight and surprise emanating from the Pusey suite, while a veritable miasma of scent, a different sort, seemed to bellow out almost to the head of the stairs. Whilst I stood on the steps outside the hotel, I could see a boy emerging from a van with an arrangement of flowers which looked positively bridal. I thought no more about it, although, had I worked it out, I would have realised that nobody would have sent flowers to Monica or Madame Bonneuil or myself, and that only left the Puseys. Of course, Jennifer might have had a boyfriend somewhere, and the high reason suggests that she must have. But somehow it seemed unlikely. I think she is the sort of girl who will never leave her mother. I have met many such daughters. Penelope, you might be surprised to know, has refused offers of marriage because, in her opinion, few of the men she meets come up to mother's exacting standards, of which I've heard so much. Penelope quotes mother as the final authority on every subject, and sometimes I envy her this certainty, this piety. I wish that I had a mother who handled down maxims on tables of stones and who was never without a wise, saw a modern instance. I never knew my poor mother to do much more than bark with derision, and yet I think of her as my poor mother. As I grow older myself, I perceive her sadness, her bewilderment that her life had taken such a turn, her loneliness. She bequeathed to me her own cloud of unknowing. She comforted herself, that harsh, disappointed woman, by reading love stories, simple romances with happy endings. Perhaps that is why I write them. In her last month she lay in bed, wearing the silk peignoir that my father bought her on their honeymoon in Venice, not caring, perhaps, not noticing, that the lace was torn, the pale blue faded to grey, and when she raised her eyes from her book, her eyes too were faded, from blue to grey, and full of dreams, longing, disenchantment. My mother's favourite fantasies, which remain unchanged all her life, taught me about reality, and although I keep reality in the forefront of my mind, and I refer to it with grim consistency, I sometimes wonder if it serves me any better than it serves my mother. But all this is by the way. I went out for the day, and when I turned up for dinner that evening, all was revealed. The dining room had emptied after the bustle of the weekend and was reduced to a paucity of numbers which spelt out end of season for anyone who had an instinct for such things. Even the waiters seemed to have given up and could be seen talking amongst themselves. Monica fed her first course to Kiki quite openly, and nobody seemed to care. Madame de Bonneuil, who eats very quickly, sits silently between courses, soothing the tablecloth with her hands. I was 3/4 of the way through my sweetbread when I was aware of a slight commotion in the doorway, and there I beheld Mrs. Pusey being led in, laughing and protesting, by Monsieur Hubert. It was clear that this was no ordinary occasion. Not only was her table decked with flowers, the ones I'd seen delivered that morning, but Mrs. Pusey had scaled heights of dressing up that put the rest of us to shame. To be quite truthful, I did not think that she had quite brought it off. Her midnight blue lace was surmounted by a sort of spangled jacket, obviously extremely expensive. This, in turn, was enlivened by several strings of beads, pearl, gold, chains, and even a rather beautiful lapis lazuli pendant. Her hair had been regilded, and her nails were flawlessly pink. I have to say she looked quite splendid, in a baroque sort of fashion. By that I mean that either she appeared out of context, or the rest of us did. It seemed to me the verdict was in the balance, only for a brief moment. After that, it began imperceptibly to go in Mrs. Pusey's direction. Of course, she willed it so, but there is always some sort of consensus in these matters, and in that crucial moment, the consensus was somehow secured. Waiters darted to pull out her chair, menus flourished in front of her, champagne produced for her inspection. Madame de Bonneuil watched all this quite impassively. Monica rolled her eyes heavenwardly. You must understand that we were not prepared for any of this. We were all in our midweek, fairly subdued evening wear, saving the one best dress for Friday and the second best dress for Saturday, and something agreeable but appropriately understated for Sunday. Inmates of institutions, we quickly learned the rules. I was wearing that green dress, which you have always disliked, safe in the knowledge that you would not be here to dislike it. Within minutes of Mrs. Pusey's arrival, I could see why you disliked it, and resolved never to wear it again. Monica was particularly but put out because, although she always looks very beautiful, on this particular evening she had managed not to. Perhaps her black dress made her look too thin and also too pale. The shadows cast by the ivory knobs of her cheekbone made her seem ill, doomed. Madame de Bonneuil was also in the black, and then she always is. I think she has two or three, at the most, black dresses of ageless, shapeless, timeless, and indeed fashionless types, into which she changes every evening. I'd be quite unable to describe these garments to you in detail, largely because they contain no detail. But I have to say that she always looks entirely correct. She looks as a woman of her age should look, and I dare say the same could be said of Monica and myself. Once these reflections had died down and I realised that Jennifer too had made an effort. Indeed, it was Monica's rather too eloquent grimaces that stimulated me into casting a glance in Jennifer's direction. What I saw was somewhat of an eye-opener, if you would permit the vulgarity. To celebrate her mother's birthday, Jennifer had attired herself in pink harem pants, teamed, as they say in the fashion mags, with an off-the-shoulder blouse. She, too, had been to the hairdresser, who had done her proud, shining blonde waves, redeemed from their earliest artlessness, had been drawn back into a kind of top knot, leaving two short ringlets bobbing in front of her ears. I had not noticed how plump she was. They both are, really, but they carry it so well that one hardly notices. Anyway, they made a brave sight, slightly bizarre, perhaps, but that may have been because the rest of us were so subdued. The thought of all the effort they had put into their preparations made me feel quite faint with exhaustion. And they are on holiday, and there was particularly nobody there to take any notice of them, except for us, of course, but we could hardly be thought adequate to the occasion, having no visible passports to this garden of earthly delights. I think there was a moment in which we felt this, and it cast a shadow over the proceedings. But Mrs. Pusey, for whom I was beginning to feel something like pity, horror, compassion, is an old hand at this game. Glasses of champagne were delivered to Monica and to Madame de Bonneuil and myself, and then we all had to drink her health, and there was a certain amount of bobbing up and down and nods and becks and wreathed smiles, most of which were cast about by Mrs. Pusey herself. Monica and Madame de Bonneuil, more stoically about this sort of celebration than I am, drank stoically, although Madame de Bonneuil raised her glass in a rather charming slow gesture before draining it. And then, when it seemed as if the entertainments were over, and the event duly noted, Alain and another boy in a white coat wheeled in a trolley on which there reposed a cake of such splendour that even Madame de Bonneuil looked impressed. Monsieur Hubert was quite beside himself with pride. Mrs. Pusely laughed and hid her face in her hands, and even applied one of her elaborate lace handkerchiefs to the corners of one eye as more champagne was poured into her glass. Jennifer expertly supervised the cutting and distribution of the cake, dispatching waiters to all our tables with chocolate-laden plates. This time, we had to raise our forks in acknowledgement. It was absolutely delicious. And of course we could hardly leave Mrs. Pusey on her own after dinner. For the first time in living memory, all the guests took their coffee together in the salon. It was not altogether homogeneous assembly, but Mrs. Pusey, her lipstick slightly smudged in the general effervescence, appeared not to mind. Madame de Bonneuil, who could hear nothing, and who was used to doing her duty, or perhaps simply to doing what was expected of her, sat it out gamely, smiling from time to time in the direction of Mrs. Pusey and nodding kindly to Jennifer. She struck me on this occasion as a creature of some nobility, for she was far from home, far from genuine reasons for celebration, and I should judge a stranger to such elaborate games of make-believe. Monica, though occasionally winking at me when she saw no one was looking, joined in with rather more enthusiasm than I would have previously have given her credit for. Indeed, she showed how well she could play the social game when she tried, although there was a satirical intention hovering over her every remark. When she went a little too far in her general teasing, I noticed that she became the object of Jennifer's level scrutiny. But Monica's genuine interest was aroused, as I knew it would be, must be. Mrs. Pusey's clothes and soon they were on almost equal terms as they exchanged the names and addresses of dressmakers. Both hit on the same one, although this was not immediately evident, since Mrs. Pusey described her as my little woman, while to Monica she was a chum of mine. For a harmonious moment, peace was restored, as they engaged in a crossfire of brand names that spanned the entire continent. Gucci and Hermès, Chanel and Jean Muir, the White House and Old England were just a few that I recognised. At this point, Madame de Bonneuil, who had perhaps endured as much as she thought was expected of her, heaved herself out of her chair, raised her stick in farewell to Mrs. Pusey, and rocked her way out of the salon. "Poor old soul," said Mrs. Pusey, in what seemed to me to be a loud voice, although, of course, Madame de Bonneuil could not hear. We kept going, though realistically the party should have broken up at this stage. You know how difficult it is to sustain an occasion when all the attention is being sucked one way. Again I noticed the Puseys, curious refusal of mutuality. Behind their extreme pleasantness, there lies something entrenched, non-negotiable, as if they can really take no one seriously but themselves. As they feel sorry for anyone who is denied the possibility of being a Pusey. And this, of course, is by definition everyone. I wonder if Jennifer is ever to marry, on which outsider will descend the supreme accolade of becoming an insider. How will he be recognised? He will have to present impeccable credentials, wealth equal to theirs, or, if possible, superior. A suitably elevated style of living, an ideally situated residence, and what Mrs. Pusey refers to as position. All these attributes will come before his physical appearance, for Jennifer might be led astray by that into making a hasty judgment. My feeling is that the chosen one will be agreeable, but perhaps not emphatically masculine. He will be courtly and not too young, and very patient and totally indulgent. He will have to be all of these things, because if he is to be a match for Mrs. Pusey's vigilance, he will have to spend a great deal of time with her, with them both. In fact, I see Jennifer's married life as being an extension of her present one. Simply, there will be three of them instead of two. The only rite of passage will be the wedding, and as this will be seen primarily as a pretext for buying more clothes, its ultimate significance will be oculated. This man, Jennifer's husband, will occupy a position equidistant between the two of them, on call in both directions. He will perforce to be the man of the family, but he will not be a Pusey. And in any event, were they not perfectly happy before he came along? Were not their standards of excellence confined to themselves? How could he possibly justify any suggestion of change? I have no feeling that Mrs. Pusey is ever going to die. With some people, I know them well, the shadow of their death precedes them. They lose hope, appetite, viability. They feel the meaning of their lives draining away, and they recognise that they have lost or never attained their heart's desire, and they give up. In the eyes of such people, one reads dreadful recognition, the ultimate self-knowledge. I have not lived enough, and it is too late to redeem myself. But Mrs. Pusey's beautiful materiality would seem to preclude such ideas. Thoughts, premonitions, whatever one cares to call them, Mrs. Pusey, having secured for herself the good things in life, has no intention of letting them go. And why should she? She knew from the outset what some unfortunates never learn. She knew that the best is there to be taken, although there may be not enough to go around. One should congratulate her on her perspicacity. Anything else one feels is probably no more or no less than sour grapes. But it's your birthday, cried Monica, who was evidently following the same train of thoughts as I was. Now, which one, I wonder? This Mrs. Pusey tried not to hear. In fact, at this point, it occurred to me that she might be a bit deaf. Although certainly, now I come to think of it, those monologues which take no account of anyone else, which are impermeable to anyone else's opinion, perhaps these are the characteristics of someone who cannot, for reasons of vanity, admit to deafness. Darling, she said to Jennifer, do and go and ask Philip to join us. He knows we don't stand on ceremony. At which Jennifer, her face once more rosy and blank, trotted over to Mr. Neville, who had somehow concealed himself whilst these celebrations were taking place, but who was now obliged to surrender his plans for the evening and join us. Monica, however, was not to be deflated. Come along now, she insisted in a playful tone, which nevertheless brokered no argument. I bet you just can't face the fact of being 60. Is that it? Well, you don't look it, Mrs. Pusey laughed. Age is a relative, she purred. You're as old as you feel, and sometimes I feel as if I'm still a girl. Her voice faded off into artless wonder as she pronounced those words to us. Her audience, she seemed to be hesitating on the brink of womanhood, amazed at the cornucopia of riches which the world had to offer her. But you're not Jennifer, said Monica rather unkindly, I thought. And so evidently did Jennifer, who scrutinised her with the same level look, a look which made her seem much older than what? Perhaps the champagne was making me feel tired. Perhaps I was tired already. But suddenly I had the uncanny feeling that this was all for show, that everything was a pretense, that this had been a dinner of masks, that no one was ever, ever going to tell the truth again. I wanted you then, David, very much, but you were not there. Only Mr. Neville was there, enjoying himself hugely. Mr. Neville, I should explain, is a connoisseur of the fantastic, an intellectual voluptuary of the highest order. The sad fact is that Mrs. Pusey, although still game, suddenly looked rather old. But when, after long and sustained courtesies on the part of Mr. Neville, she finally revealed that she was 79, we were all genuinely astonished. Calculations flashed through our minds. Each of us knew exactly what the others were thinking. If Mrs. Pusey admits to 79, then Jennifer must be about my age, mine and Monica's, and that is what she is. Jennifer, like me, is 39, although her curious combination of plump body and expressionless face makes her seem no older than 14. For what Jennifer instantly expresses, now that I come to think of it, is latency. She has the unsettling presence, or possibly the equal unsettling absence, of many adolescents. Her apparently uninformed voluptuousness would be almost shocking if it were not cancelled by her daughterly obedience. Jennifer is blatantly wholesome, seemingly innocent. Yet in comparison, I, who are none of these things, feel like the maiden aunt. It was then that Mrs. Pusey, coaxed on by the attentive Neville, told us how the early years of her marriage were overshadowed by the complicated, inexplicable absence of children. Here another snowy handkerchief was produced from her bag, shaken out and applied to the corner of her lips. No matter how hard we tried, she said, nothing seemed to work. She sighed. This remark hung rather heavily in the atmosphere. Monica brooded, whilst I wished that I had left earlier. With Madame de Bonneuil, then, after 12 years of selfless and dedicated trying, Mrs. Pusey's efforts were rewarded, and lo and behold, there was Jennifer. My husband always wanted a little girl. Here she turned to Jennifer, who flashed her another expected smile and lovingly held out her hand. Thus encouraged, Mrs. Pusey went on to regale us with the anecdotes of Jennifer's early life. Needless to say, these were all they would have hoped for, although she was outrageously spoiled. Well, when you've waited so long, you tend to give them everything they want, don't you? And my husband couldn't bear to see her in tears. It upset him dreadfully. Iris, he used to say, let her have the best. I'll leave you a blank check. And so he did. And she's none the worse for a bit of spoiling, are you, darling? Again, the smile, the outstretched hand, and certainly Jennifer's glossy health would seem a more than adequate repayment for such efforts, on which, for some obscure reason, Mrs. Pusey had to be congratulated all over again. I have to tell you, David, that among other things, Jennifer had a pony called Twiglet, and when we had the full recital again, Haslemere, head office, and how she had everything delivered. Edith laid down her pen. This letter would have to be finished later, and even probably revised. Unsound elements seemed to have crept into her narrative. She was aware of exceeding her brief, and was then aware of restrictions that brief implied. To assume, to divert, to relax. These had been her functions, and indeed her dedicated aim. But something had gone wrong or was slipping out of control. What had been undertaken as an exercise in entertainment, for had not the situation seemed appropriate, tailor-made for such exercise, had somehow accumulated elements of introspection, of criticism, even of bitterness. Well, darling, what news from Cranford? David used to say, stretching out his long arm to gather her to him as they sat on her big sofa. And that had always been her cue to present him with a gentle observation, always skilfully edited, and to watch the lines of fatigue on his lean and foxy face dissolve into a smile. For that is how he saw me, she thought, and out of love for him, that is how I tried to be. But now, possibly because of the champagne, she felt unsettled, wary. There seemed to be no immediate reason for this except fatigue, stretched nerves. The evening, of course, had gone on far too long for an extraordinary day. At some point, Monica had started to tell her story to Mrs. Pusey, who listened with avid interest, masked by an air of solicitous condescension. There seemed to be no means of escape. Jennifer, one ankle balanced on the opposite knee, this attitude permitted by the entirely modest amplitude of her harem plants, yet still managed to be both childish and inappropriate, seemed to have absented herself once more behind her docile face. She lay back in her chair, toying with her curls, her eyes watching from under half-closed lids. From her teeth, a tiny thread of saliva hung, glistening. Edith swallowed invisible yawns. She was aware that even Mr. Neville was mildly inattentive, although his habitual courtesy of expression gave nothing away. They'd still been there at midnight. Monica, once launched, was not to be sidetracked. And cigarette after cigarette was smoked, and Mrs. Pusey had nothing really helpful to offer in the way of advice, indeed memories of her own term of trial, so successfully concluded, inclined her only to bracing clichés, which had not gone down too well. Monica's face had dropped into its habitual lines of discontent, and the evening had ended on a distinctly less harmonious note than on which it had started, and at one point had bid fair to continue. At least Kiki was absent, shut in Monica's bathroom again by Alain after yet another misdemeanour. Monsieur Hubert, somewhat disappointed in his role of master of ceremonies, had nevertheless stayed downstairs hoping for words of appreciation, but these were not forthcoming. It seemed as if everyone was too tired to redeem the situation, and when Mr. Neville offered his arm to Mrs. Pusey, she was only too happy to accept it. It took a little longer than usual for her to lever herself out of her chair, but finally she had left, leaning on Mr. Neville, with Jennifer bringing up the rear. Edith, reaching the haven of her room, closing the door behind her, tried to discover the reason for her low spirits, which seemed intricately bound up with the events of the evening and the thoughts it had provoked. Was it that she was simply a stranger to the very act of celebration? Mrs. Pusey's birthday, Jennifer's imagined wedding, had seemed to her so very much more three-dimensional than anything she could remember in her own life. For her, birthdays and her parents' health, Edith herself had made the cake, and her father had brought it in, ceremoniously, with the coffee. Those occasions had been brief and timid excursions into family life, as she had supposed they might ideally live it. Her mother was stimulated in reminiscence of the coffee houses of her youth, and had talked vividly and amusingly before falling once again into the sorrow of reminiscence. By that time the coffee had been drunk, and on the plate the cake lay in ruins, and when Edith carried it back to the kitchen, her birthday had been over, and there had never been any mention of weddings. And now, paradoxically, in this blessed silence and dimness of her room, Edith felt her own fatigue dissolve, and the underlying unease of which she had been intermittently aware of during the writing of her letter began to stir, to increase, to take over, and at this very late hour she felt her heart beat, and her reason, that controlling element to fragment, as hidden areas, dangerous shoals, erupted into her consciousness. The careful pretense of her days here, the almost successful tenor of this artificial and meaningless life which had been decreed for her own good by others, and who had no real understanding of what her own good was, suddenly appeared to her in all their futility. Perhaps the champagne, the cake, the celebrations had eroded the barriers of her mind, trailing sly and unwelcome associations, making a nonsense of those careful arrangements she had worked out for herself, banishing amusement, returning her seriousness and painful reflection, demanding on accounting. She had thought that by consenting to this tiny exile she was clearing the decks, wiping the slate, and that she would be allowed to return, suitably chastised, in due course to resume her life. "I am clearing the decks, Edith," she remembered her father saying as he tore up the papers on his desk. "Just clearing the decks." He had smiled, but his eyes were full of sad knowledge. He had known that nothing would be the same for him again, that his stay in the hospital was not to be the brief interlude he had bracingly told her mother it would be, and he had not come home. "And maybe I shall not go home," she thought, her heart breaking with sorrow, and beneath the sorrow she felt vividly unsafe, as she did when she saw that the plot of a novel would finally resolve itself, and how this might be brought about. Sitting alone in the silence, she bowed her head and passed scrupulously in review the events that had brought her, out of season, to the Hôtel du Lac.